Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Let's Talk, the show that tries to bring you the most important conversations in art, culture, and ideas. And today I'm at the Lost Food Project and its warehouse here in the heart of Kuala Lumpur. With me is Shazwan Mokhtar, he's the general manager, to talk about the question of food, not just the cuisines we like and not just, you know, what farmers do, but the end result of food production, which is food waste, and so much of it is wasted. Not just in the month of Ramadan, which media often focuses on, but actually throughout the year. Shazwan, I began with that assertion that food, in fact, is wasted throughout the year. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it's a given, especially here in Malaysia, the way we consume food, the amount of food that we consume on a daily basis. Yes, we, in fact, if you look at the study done by SWCorp, I mentioned this.
The landfill operator.
Yeah, correct. The recent study, I think, was done in 2021, at least published in 2021. We waste about 4,000 tons of edible food on a daily basis. In fact, this is an increase from the earlier study back in 2019, I think, where it was about 3,300 tons on a daily basis. So you can see the number increasing, maybe because of different factors and reasons. It can be, you know, population growth. It can be just, you know, people stocking up because of the pandemic and so on. But in the end, you know, it is a lot of food being wasted.
Okay, let's talk about the food that's being wasted in a granular sense, right? So you talk about people stocking up. So they're stocking up food that they couldn't consume within the time for perishables, right, and such. What about the food that we scrape off our plate at the end of a meal? Is that also counted as waste food?
That is counted as waste, but not necessarily edible waste. I mean, if you look at the data that's provided, waste food is a lot more than that. 4,000 tons are those which are edible, still of good quality, can still be consumed and so on. But in terms of waste food itself, there's a lot more, I think, definitely more than 4,000 tons.
Right, so we're looking at the problem of food that doesn't need to be wasted, basically.
Correct.
And you come in, and the Lost Food Project comes in as an attempt to resolve the problem of food that's gone to waste, that didn't have to go to waste, that could have been consumed, or perhaps shouldn't have been produced in the first place. And so let's talk about that. I mean, tell us about the genesis of the Lost Food Project.
All right, so basically the Lost Food Project, as you rightly mentioned earlier, that we exist in order to rescue surplus food. You know, we rescue them and redistribute it back to communities, B40 communities, to charities, organizations, people who are in need, regardless of background, whether it's, you know, your race, religion, gender, even refugees or something that you know, at communities that we help. So that, in essence, is what we do. We connect through our partners, food partners, you know, whether it's bakeries, wholesalers, manufacturers, suppliers, and so on and so forth. In order to rescue this food, of course, we have our operations, you know, we have our trucks, we have our volunteers and our drivers and all that to collect on a daily basis and distribute currently around 10 to 12,000 people on a weekly basis.
Right, so that's quite impressive. But in terms of the overall problem, the 4,000 tons of food wasted on a daily basis.
Correct.
What percentage are you rescuing?
Not a lot. You mentioned 4 tons. That's basically what we are able to do.
So 1%.
Yeah, 1%. That's no. It's just a drop in the ocean, if you want to consider it like that. Because in the end, last year, for example, was our biggest haul for throughout the whole existence of the Lost Food Project, where we collected around 1.2 million kilograms of food, which is about 1,200 tons of food in total being collected. And that's not even a single day's worth of food being wasted.
So the problem is enormous. You guys come in with the best of intentions, and you can manage this. We're in your warehouse, which is quite modest when we think about the scale of the problem.
Yeah.
I believe that's your colleague there in the background, you know, who runs the warehouse. How much of a logistical challenge is this work?
I mean, we didn't realize our potential really until COVID came to town, really. During the pandemic, we had to kind of shift our operations a bit more. We were, of course, working through our operations at the warehouse. You know, people, you know, send food here and then we do distribution and all of that. But we realized that our potential can also be bigger than that. And then we developed a model where it's a bit more platform-based. You know, having this small warehouse shouldn't be a limit to what we can do as on a logistics aspect. You know, if we have trucks, we have the drivers, we have our partners, you know, whether it's logistic partners, whether it's our food partners, they have their warehouse, they have their logistics capabilities as well. So it is about making sure that we are able to connect all our network. You know, if we have 30 pallets of food, for example, coming to the warehouse on a single day, you cannot keep it here. This warehouse can probably store maybe at most 10 pallets, right? So how do we distribute it early? So we have to distribute within a day, call our contacts, you know, call our partners to come in and make sure all the logistics and scheduling is in tune with you know, with the distribution that can be done within a single day. So again, it is about having the right network, and we know that a lot of people out there who are in need. I mean, this year alone, we've seen the results, the latest study saying that the number of hardcore poor has risen by 270%. Right, so meaning that there are a lot of people out there who are in need, and every time that we are able to collect food, we know that there are people out there who are able to, you know, take it in.
So that we have a chain now. We have the people who have, yeah, and have perhaps too much and are wasting food, maybe intentionally or unintentionally, yeah, and then you come in to supply the people who don't have enough food.
Correct.
Right. So food waste is linked intimately to hunger as well, I think, in this country. And
yeah,
perhaps we don't talk enough about hunger and malnutrition in this country as we should.
Right.
But before we even get to these kind of larger questions, I still want to understand what's stopping you from scaling up. You say you're dealing with 1% of a very important deal with. What's not happening? Is it policy? Is it, you know, government? Is it private sector? Is it the fact that the market is designed to create waste and doesn't want waste to, in fact, re-enter the market, which would be a problem for them, right? Producers want to keep prices at a certain level, and people are getting free food, they're not going to buy food.
Correct. I think there are definitely different levels to it. I think you mentioned policy, maybe policies can be improved in order to kind of support this initiative and in order to incentivize at least those who are wasting, right? So we talk about the Food Donors Act, I think that came about, gazetted maybe 2 years ago or last year. That opened up a lot of doors for us. We allowed a lot of partners, a lot of, you know, suppliers and food producers to come to us with confidence that they wouldn't be liable if should anything happen to.
Right. So can you explain that? What is the liability here, and why does the Food Donor Act help?
You know, there's a lot of worry, I think, in terms of just being fearful of food going to people and then people getting sick or you know, it affects them in some negative way, right? So the Food Donors Bill came into effect, which protected the donors from such liability, unless, and you know, it is intentionally done or something like that. So with that act in place, it allows the donors to go to us or come to us or any charity or anyone who needs food without being fearful of any repercussions.
Right. So as I understand it, producers often have a shelf life for their products, and that shelf life is designed to not get the... It's not like the food isn't inedible after that shelf life. It's just that by doing so, they're erring on the side of caution, right?
Correct.
And also maybe to maintain...
The quality,
yeah, right? And the expectations that their customers have. So like things might get slightly discolored, but actually are perfectly good, right?
Correct, yeah.
So the Food Donor Act allows producers to some leeway in donating. So the thing is, how do you resolve things like, is the food that is donated in fact safe? Because, you know, it's sometimes worrying when you think, oh, that, you know, people in need will be given cast-offs or you know overdue food just because it solves the kind of warehousing problem for the producer.
That is a kind of stigma to any food that gets, you know, just balance of something and being thrown away or things like that. But these are actually quality still indeed food. Most of the food that we collect, and we have a policy, a standards where we also share with our food partners. So these are our policies. When you want to give food, you know, it's still in date, it's still of good quality. Even those which are either close to expiry or expired, you know, there are ways, and we have partners who are experts in kind of handling this kind of food as well. You know, you can still cook it, you can still consume it, provided, you know the taste and the smell of it. You know, there are many, many different ways to look at it. But in terms of just ensuring that the food is given to us, it can still be consumed, and we know we have partners who are willing to take it in. So that's a step forward for any kind of dealing in this kind of initiative and program. In the end, I think what was missing before was that people weren't aware that they were able to give. People were just doesn't have enough confidence in giving, in fact. And there's a stigma behind the food being just balance of something else. But I think that has kind of changed, especially over the past 2 to 3 years, at least from our point of view, our observations as well. When we give to people, when we start to connect with people and to start to engage people, people are more than willing, just that there was never an opportunity for them to take it in.
Right, okay. So, and very quickly, the people you give food to, are they happy to take it? You give it to them free?
Yeah, we give them to them free. We get them for free, we give it to them free. So if anything, they're more than happy to take it. Yeah.
Okay.
There's always a community that's willing to take it. I mean, of course, you know, some communities do not prefer certain food items. You know, we talk about giving to children, for example. We received bitter gourd yesterday. We were, you know, that's definitely not a segment of society that we will give to, right? But older generations, the elderly, they're more than willing to take them in. So we still have to do some kind of sorting on our part, right, to ensure that it goes to the right place and doesn't go wasted.
Right. So this warehouse is very quiet, but I understand a lot of sorting happened earlier today.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. So this is where we do our sorting. We receive food from Pasar Burung, Kuala Lumpur, for example, on a daily basis. Once a week, we do the sorting here at the warehouse for charity distribution. So it's rather busy earlier in the day.
Right, okay. We'll take a short break now and we'll be back with more on the Lost Food Project here in the heart of Kuala Lumpur. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Shaurya Kutin with Misha Azwan Mokhtar, General Manager of the Lost Food Project here in the heart of Kuala Lumpur. We're at their warehouse, a very modest place, considering the enormity of the work they do and the issue that they represent, which is, you know, surplus food going to waste at a huge amount. So again, you kind of outlined for us, you know, some of the barriers to expanding and such, but I want to ask you, as a project and somebody who's the general manager in a kind of leadership position, what kind of conversations are you involved in, not just in Malaysia, but elsewhere, that are helping you in your work and helping you think about, you know, innovation or think about new ways to communicate the importance of this issue to a wider public?
I think and one thing about Malaysia being what we are, I mean, we're a bit late into the game. So that is an advantage in terms of us just expanding our knowledge into this kind of operations, into food banking, for example. So we are able to kind of collect a lot of different ideas and experiences from other countries who are already well-versed into this field, and who are so matured in terms of food banking. For example, the Netherlands has more than 400 food banks, right? I've had conversations with people in Singapore, in Thailand, and also the Dutch embassy also invited and had forums and so on. So, you know, there are a lot of NGOs that just and organizations and associations that, you know, prepare platforms for a lot of the connection, especially because over the past 2 years we've been exposed to a lot more kind of international networking through Zoom, for example. So it allows others to immediately invite us for conversations and discussions and panels, forums and all that. So, I mean, there's a lot out there. I think that's an advantage for us because, for example, when I learn about innovative dealing of logistics chaining for this type of operation, you know, I look at that things done in India, for example, and the mature market in the UK, in Australia. So, you know, it's just about how we replicate those in our context. In
Is this conversation happening in Malaysia?
This conversation is happening, I think, sporadically. There is, for example, we are part of a strategic partnerships under the Ministry of Consumer Affairs. us, you know, the Law Soup Project and a few other food banks, and we have had meetings and discussions to discuss operations and the sharing of knowledge and also sharing of resources and so on. But it's not done to an extent where we discuss the nitty-gritty or the details of the issue itself.
Okay, but what about that conversation that's broader, right? I know that during Ramadan, the media loves to talk about food that goes to waste, and you know, much of it is kind of a guilt-tripping people about the food they waste. And I'm not sure if that's in many ways productive, because what it seems to me at least, and even when I look at my own practice as an individual, oftentimes we don't intentionally waste food. It's because we don't have knowledge about how to make food last in our refrigerators and store things properly, or and so on and so forth, right? And are there champions in this conversation? Are people and groups or media that is actually focused on the range of issues that are implicated in what you're dealing with, which is the end product, right? I mean, it's somebody talking to the farmers about why are they creating surpluses, and so on and so forth.
I think there's, to be honest with you, there's not a lot of conversations going on out there, at least in Malaysian context. Yes, a lot of other NGOs are doing their best to ensure that there are sustainability factors put into the conversations. There are ways that we can kind of affect change through awareness and education program, and you know, organizations such as Seed Malaysia, Zero Waste Malaysia. They talk about how to conserve food, how to preserve food, and so on and so forth. But talking to farmers and things like that, I think that goes beyond our capabilities as well as an NGO. We cannot reach those that can make real changes, that can make policy changes and so on. So I think those are the conversations that are kind of lacking a bit. But I know a lot also being done to ensure that, for example, the government announced investments or funding into technologies in farming and so on. So that will help production. But what happens to those food that does not get get sold, for example, or those food that gets lost during the whole supply logistics aspect of it and so on. So those are the conversations that I feel that's still a little bit lacking, and we have not been involved in many of them as well. I know we've been invited to a few that when we are involved in those discussions, some ideas are being thrown about, but I'm not sure whether any follow-ups are done. So.
Right, and so, you know, when we look around, and I just listened to this wonderful podcast about like a city in, you know, in Indonesia, Semarang, doing a lot on climate resilience. And I know that the issue of, you know, dumped food has implications for the climate, right? And and so on, production of methane gas. So
correct,
whatever.
Yeah.
So I think, why isn't there a Malaysian city that's championing this? Why don't we have that kind of innovation? It's, you know, that was trying to resolve these very important issues that the benefits of which are more than just, you know, feeling good that we're doing something for the planet, but actually will transform the way we deal with nature.
Yeah, I to be honest, I'm quite stumped myself. I mean, I've again, organizations that we work with, for example, SW Corp, are trying really hard to kind of ensure that we get the surplus and you know, looking into the sustainability aspect. In fact, DBKL also has a few programs like composting among communities and all that, incentivizing communities to give waste and recycle and so on and so forth. But again, that is only at the tail end of it, right? So you talk about the discussions that are happening in terms of reducing food waste and reducing the number of surplus that we have and so on and so forth. I think that goes into and that goes deeper into the conversation that we've never had the opportunity to be a part of. And I think in the end, what we can really rely on is education at a more primary level, at school level. And, you know, it probably difficult now to kind of change generational kind of perception on this. But of course, we can always look into the next generation and how they perceive food and how they value food a bit more.
So that's interesting, because you're saying that, you know, let's use school. Right? School means it's a ministry. Some ministry's got to get involved.
Yeah.
It's got to be put into the curriculum. But the people running it are precisely the generation, you say, whose perceptions, militate against, you know, change, right?
Yeah.
What is it that you think people think are thinking in ways that prevent them from seeing this as a problem?
You know, it's again generational. We've been taught, you know, for example, just simply when food is past expiry date, you throw it away immediately. So there's no one telling us that, you know, it still actually can, it's still of good quality, it can still be consumed, it's just not to the level that the manufacturers want us to consume it, right? So these are things that we have been passed down for generations, and our policymakers are not the youngest, I would say.
Are you being generous?
And that being said, you know, it does kind of affect certain policies as well when it comes to how things are looked at, whether it can be progressive in that sense. So again, our take is that, and we set up our own education unit because of this, you know, going to school to talk about food waste. If the schools or the syllabus cannot be changed, then we have to make an effort to go down to the school and at least be part of the conversation, make sure that the children are part of the conversation as well, because they are the ones that are going to be affected in the future. You know?
Yeah. So, you know, you mentioned SW Corp, which is the landfill operator. Yeah. And, you know, clearly, and your vans have this wonderful saying, feed the hungry, not the landfills. Yeah. And landfills themselves are a problem. I used to live in Ampang where, you know, every so often it caught fire and we had this horrible
fumes
coming out from the landfills. So there is an issue at so many levels.
Yeah.
I kind of hope and pray that policymakers hear what you're saying and act on it. But what would you say you would want first in the many steps that you need to take to achieve impact in terms of your work? Yeah. What would you like to see government or the private sector do?
It is, again, when, you know, the moment I start work with the LFU, for example, I realized then that it is not a single organization effort, it is a concerted effort. Everyone has to be involved, whether it's the private companies, you know, them giving more items and more surplus out is already a step in the right direction. But also policy is so very important. That's how you change mindset, that's how you change culture, that's how you change, unfortunately in Malaysia especially, because we are so ingrained in the way we think, or ingrained in the way we act on politics, right, for example. So once the policies change, we change our kind of approach towards something. So that's where it has to start. I think education, of course, is a very big factor in it as well. Just changing people's behavior towards food and the way they look at conservation and sustainability and so on and so forth. But having the right policies in place moves things forward in a more lasting manner.
Right. Thank you so much, Azwan. I've been speaking to Shazwan Mokhtar, as General Manager of the Lost Food Project. So next time you put something in your mouth, think about where it came from and where it's going to go after. That's all I have for you on Let's Talk today. I'm Sharad Kutan, only for Astro 1-8.